You wanna give love to the city, that's a fact. But you're gonna need help if you wanna make an impact.
Well endowed,
you want to be
well endowed
with the Edmonton community.
Things really happen when you find that you're well endowed.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Well Endowed Podcast, brought to you by Edmonton Community Foundation and a proud affiliate member of Alberta Podcast Network. We bring you community discourse about amazing organizations and people who come together to make Edmonton strong. I'm Elizabeth Bonkink.
I'm Andrew Paul.
And I'm Janelle Jensen.
Hi, Janelle. Glad to have you here with us.
Yeah, welcome, Janelle. Janelle is our intrepid summer intern from McEwen University's journalism program, and she's been working on some stories for our Legacy in Action magazine and for the Well Endowed podcast. So, Janelle, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, well, like Andrew said, I'm from McEwen University Journalism Program, and I just completed my fourth year. I am a lover of anything related to coffee, food, and adventure, and I am really looking forward to being part of today's podcast with you guys.
So what do we have lined up for this month's episode?
This month, we'll hear from two Olympians, including Jen Kish. Jen was the captain of the Canada's women's sevens rugby team for the Olympic Games at Rio in 2016, and we'll hear her thoughts on diversity and inclusion in sports. But first, we'll catch up with Brian McKeever, Canada's most decorated winter Paralympian.
That's right. Brian McKeever has racked up 17 medals in 5 trips to the Paralympic Winter Games, including 14 gold. He's the most decorated Paralympian cross-country skier ever. Brian will be speaking at Edmonton Community Foundation's annual meeting on June 7th, but more details on that later. He took some time out for a phone call with our producer, Lisa Pruden, to share a bit about his journey as an athlete. Let's take a listen.
Welcome, Brian. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So how are you feeling coming off of your 5th Paralympic event?
Well, pretty tired. There's always a bit of an emotional letdown after the games, and I think that has a lot to do with the expectations that we put on ourselves and the fact that it's 4 years of prep for one event, and then once that week is done, you crash pretty hard, and I think like a lot of the teams feeling the same thing.
What are you doing to have your downtime and to, I guess, regulate yourself again?
Just a lot of resting at home for now. I've been trying to get out and still have some fun and head out into the backcountry a little bit and do some of that type of stuff. Try and do things that would be fun, I guess, that you don't feel like you have to. It's trying to take the job out of the training process, I suppose. We're just starting to understand how much of an impact that a major championship can have on an athlete psychologically, emotionally. You know, I was feeling pretty bad about myself for not having done more, and called some of the other guys, and they're feeling the same way. So I think that's it's just a normal thing.
Just thinking back at the Paralympic experience, this was your first time marching in the opening ceremonies, was it?
Yes, it was.
You were asked to carry Canada's flag. What did that mean to you?
Well, it's a huge honor. Anybody that's ever had the opportunity, of which there are few, they all say the same thing, that it was one of the best experiences of their careers. And it's the same for me. It's not even so much about like walking out representing the country. I mean, that's a big part of it. And that was part of what makes you very nervous about the process. For me, it was also the big group of athletes that are following behind you. You know, looking back as we were walking into the stadium, and you see all these smiling faces, and they're excited and they're ready to go. And you know that they all have their hopes and dreams on the line, coming up in the next 10 days. And that's actually quite a special moment just to see that and to feel a big part of that and to feel that I was representing the team that was going to be competing. And that was nerve-wracking to an extent, but also an experience that I'll never forget. So it was great.
And do you have any moments or memories that stand out for you?
Yeah, I've marched in a few closing ceremonies for one thing, and it's not the same. There's not as much anticipation, I suppose, as what's about to happen in the opening ceremonies. It's a lot more raw energy going out there, and you know, you're standing and you're being told what to do because you have to follow at certain distances and things like that. So you're like trying to make sure you don't break protocols and do all. So that's like you're trying to think of all this. But one thing I kept having in my mind was, you know, like, how do we make this more fun? And I was like talking to the chef to me, so I'm like, hey, can I ride the flag out there like Happy Gilmore? He's laughing. He's like, yeah, do it. The guides are like, don't you dare.
So not only are you the most decorated Paralympian in Canada, you are also the only athlete to be named to both the Olympic and Paralympic teams. Is that right?
the only Canadian winter athlete, at least as far as I know.
That's very cool. Can you tell us a bit about that?
It was an interesting time. In 2005, I was national champion on aggregate, so over the full week of the national championship races. And I knew that the shape that I was in at the time, if I was skiing in Europe instead of in Canada, that I would have had a good shot. The World Championships were going on at the same time, and I felt that if I had been there, that I would have had a shot to make the Olympic standard. And so I decided to make that a goal for 2006, to try and make Torino. And I worked quite hard over the summer, and halfway through the year, I knew it was going really poorly, and I had to make some adjustments. I had to talk to people that were far smarter than me, and I met a man named Dave Smith at UFC. He was the physiologist there, and he's the head physiologist at Canadian Sport Institute in Calgary now. And we just went over the training and what I'd done, and he's like, I know what you've done, and don't worry, we can fix it. And so it really did save the end of that year, because without him and that training program, I don't think I would have hit the podium at all. When we debriefed in the spring, he asked what the goal was, and I said, well, the goal is in 4 years' time to be at the Olympics. If I can be at that level, then I know the Paralympics will take care of themselves as well. So that's what we did for 4 years. We worked specifically on qualifying for the Olympics, you know, being as specific as possible with those goals and coming up with a really good plan in order to make it happen and executing as well as possible for 4 years. That was what it took in order to qualify. So it was a pretty neat thing. Like, I mean, it's one of those, you're on the edge of realizing a lot of little childhood dreams that stem right back to 1988 for me, watching the Olympics in my hometown. And that was really the start of it. And 98 as well for me was special because my brother was at the Olympics there. So to have those things kind of as fuel for the dream, I think was also very important for me.
Do you mind if we chat a little bit about your visual impairment?
Yeah, no worries.
Would you mind describing for our listeners what Stargardt disease is? And also, am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, I think so. I actually learned recently I don't have Stargardt's per se. I guess the technical name for it is a Stargardt-like inherited retinal dystrophy. And I guess what that means is it has effectively the same end result, which is macular degeneration, which is the loss of central vision. But it uses a different genetic mechanism. So in our case, my family, it's a dominant gene, which is apparently fairly rare. My dad has it. My aunt has it. His sister, their father had it. So this is one of those ones that, because it's a dominant gene, it doesn't skip generations. You either have it or you don't. If you have it, there's a 50-50 chance of passing it on to your kids. If you don't have it, 0% chance. It's been eliminated from the gene pool. So my brother doesn't have it, and so therefore can't pass it on at all. So what it causes is the cells in the middle of the retina at the back, so it's basically like the film of a camera, it causes them to die and not be receptive to light. It creates a blind spot right in the middle, so it'd be like exposing the film camera just in the center and then trying to take a picture. So everything around the outside is clear, and then dead center, there's just nothing. Depending on where I'm looking, things will disappear and reappear as they move in and out of that blind spot and into the peripheral where I see. So I always kind of joke and say, I see the donut, I don't see the Timbit. But the closest way I can describe it is probably like if people are looking into a bright light or the sun or something like that, and they get that, you get that fuzzy blob in the middle that eventually fades back to being able to see. But that's kind of what I have with the whole, all the time.
Did it help, having seen your father and aunt already deal with this, did it help when you got your diagnosis to give an idea?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, we are the sum of our experiences, and our first teachers are our parents. We learn so much from them. And in our family, it was totally normal. You know, Dad always joked about blind old Bill, you know, talking about himself. And then it was just normal for us. Just the way he dealt with it was by almost ignoring it, I suppose, as being an issue. And he grew up on the farm, so you just, like stuff like that, you just ignored, because did it really affect your life? Not at all. You go out, you do the work, you know, you make your life what it is. And so I think initially I still had an adjustment period to it, that because it hit me late. I was 18 or so. Still, when the diagnosis hits, you're like, I mean, it's still a loss, even though you don't know how bad it might be. And initially, I think no matter what, you have a knee-jerk reaction where you think it's going to be so much worse than it really is. And you think about all these ways that your life is going to change. And I mean, this is literally like within days. I think that adjustment period and like dealing with the emotional part of that loss is different for every person. In my case, I think it was made a lot easier because of the normalcy of it in my family. And so I had a couple of weeks where I cried a lot and thought that my life was going to change so much. And when I look back now, I realize that my life really hasn't changed all that much at all, not in any real meaningful way, at least in terms of the negatives, because we only ever focus on the negatives.
Right.
You know, oh, I'm not going to be able to do this anymore, or I won't be able to do this in the future. But you don't think about life as a whole of how it's going to change. And I think for me, in the end, like I say, it was a couple of weeks before I realized I had to pull myself together and just start dealing with it the way my dad did. And that was effectively ignoring it, like understanding the limitations that there might be, but crossing those bridges when you get there, as opposed to worrying about what may happen in a year, in 10 years, in 30 years, whatever. So that helped me to maybe more live in the present, I suppose. And I rarely think of myself as having a disability. And I think when you talk about when you talk to a lot of Paralympic athletes, they would probably say the same thing because they've learned to deal with it. For some people, it's taken years, and for some people, it's taken months. And it just, you know, that's a very personal thing. In my case, it was, you know, within less than a year, I was, had kind of forgotten about it already. And I think that was because of the family.
So when did you decide to become a para-athlete?
Well, that's actually kind of a funny story. I never consciously made the decision quickly, that's for sure. I mean, I've been a skier my whole life. I was moving up the ladder quite well, following in my brother's footsteps, and Robin had almost qualified in 94 for the Olympics. And then he did qualify in 98, and that was the year that I got the diagnosis. And that same year, I qualified for the World Junior Championships. So it was my first international trip, and it all seemed to be like I was moving along the path that he was. So then I had the diagnosis, and that was part of the adjustment period, was the knee-jerk reaction was, well, I'm never going to be able to do this. I won't be able to ski like I did. And I was also going through mono at the time. That spring, I got sick. It was like, if ever there was a time to quit, now would be the time. Like, seems to be so many things conspiring against a career. But I love the sport, and so I remember saying to Robin that, oh, I kind of owe it to myself to try and get healthy and just keep going as long as it's safe. I remember saying, I just kept skiing, kept racing. And then one day the head coach from the para team came and talked to me in Canmore. And he asked if I'd ever given any thought to joining their program. And I think I laughed at him. I kind of went, well, yeah, but I don't have a disability. He goes, it's not about having a disability. He says, we all have disabilities. Whether it's physical or whether it's emotional or whether it's mental, he's like, everybody's got an issue. He goes, but if you're classifiable as far as Paralympics goes, I want you on my program. I'd never considered myself as having a disability. I'm like, I don't have a disability, so I'm not going to join this program, right? And Robin and I are talking about it that night, and we were laughing about it initially, like, yeah, you're not disabled. Like, look at you. There's nothing obviously wrong. And then the more we talked about it, the more I was like, well, but wait, it's a chance to be on a national team program, which is hard to get to on the able-bodied side. Like, I was close, but this gave me the opportunity to get funding and be paid to ski, be a professional skier right now, not in 2 years from now, but like now. That was sort of the start of it all. I actually wasn't disabled enough at the time, for lack of a better way of putting it. My eyesight hadn't degenerated to the point that I was classifiable. And so we had to wait a year. It's interesting looking back on it now, because it would have been an easy thing to have brushed aside and to ignore and just to go off and keep racing on the able-bodied side only. That would have been an opportunity missed, because I've accomplished so much more in my career from having the support of the para team than I would have ever done just on the able-bodied side.
And it sounds like your brother was right there beside you for it. How has your family helped you along the way?
I mean, he and I, we're 6 years apart. He's older, and when we were younger, I mean, we weren't really close, because 6 years, a big age difference. When I was a kid, you know, I was probably the little pain in the ass brother that he had, and he was the jerk that always teased me and what, you know, like, you know, even, he was good. He took care of me and whatnot. But still, like, there's always that dynamic with siblings. He was an adult while I was still a child. And by the time we were actually the year that he went to the Olympics, I went to the World Junior Championships was really cool because at the trials races, he was helping me test my skis. And he goes, you know what? These just aren't good enough. Here, you're racing on my best skis today. And he just gave me his. That was a big moment because, I mean, how could you give any more confidence to a racer than knowing that you're on one of the best pair of skis in the whole country? Thanks to that and the confidence that he gave me with that, that I managed to qualify. So he became the mentor to me in that process. By the time I qualified for the disabled team, the Paranordic team, my first races, I was skiing alone with no guide. We get to the first races, and there was a German guy that was basically in the position I'm in now who hadn't lost in 6 years or whatever it was, like rarely challenged. I was 30 seconds behind him in this first race, and they came straight to me. Him and his guide came to me, and they said, you know, this is super exciting that there's somebody coming up young, ready to challenge. Like, they're ready to pass on the torch a bit. And those guys said, you know, if you'd had a guide today, you might have won because you've got that support. You've got a draft the entire way. Like, you might have skied 30 seconds faster. So if you're going to challenge in this sport, you have to get a guide. And my first thought was to call Robin. I mean, it's tough. He's also having his own career. And for somebody to put that career aside for whether it's a few weeks a year or whether it's full time, that's a very difficult thing to ask of anybody. Yet with Robin, he was more than willing to come and try it out. I think we ended up winning a few races and then qualifying for the Paralympic Games. And that was the start of us working together. And over that time, we became best friends and, you know, we became brothers for real. And so that was maybe the best thing about that whole time period was not the racing, the success we had, but the fact that we reconnected on that level. And that was all thanks to Parasport. In a way, Parasport's helped the family, but, you know, family sticks together pretty hard. And that was very evident in that sense that he was willing to put his career aside individually so that we could be a team.
That's a wonderful story. So one thing I really wanted to ask was, what do you love about skiing?
Well, I love everything about it. There's a term that gets tossed around about being a student of the sport. That could be anything, really. I mean, that could be a student of whatever profession that is that you have, that while you can be an expert in it, there's always things to learn. There's always things to understand about it. And I love that process. The techniques that are involved, little things make big differences. There's always something to learn. There's always something to improve. And the thing with techniques in sport is that if you don't work on them constantly, they go away. And it's a very fluid process. Some days you have it, some days you don't. It's a bit of a frustrating process as well, that you could be out one day and everything's going great, and the next day it's terrible and you can't figure out why. Instead of getting frustrated, for me, I love working on that stuff and trying to figure out the whys of it. And Dad was a bit of a scientist. He was an elementary school phys ed teacher, but he also taught science. And so I think I got that love of science from him. And so I see it as a scientific experiment, I suppose, from how the technique is, the exercise physiology of how to train a body to be at its best. I like experimenting on myself with the training. Now we're going to change up the training program. Let's see if that makes a good result. And if it does, great, we keep it. If it doesn't, well, you throw it out and you try again. I like the aspects of ski selection and what makes a good ski, you know, going through the Fisher factory in Austria and handpicking our race skis for the year and discussing what's going to make the best match pair of skis for my techniques and the way that I race, to the waxing side of the chemistry that goes into the ski waxes and how you combine the different waxes in order to make the best pair of the fastest pair of skis. You know, I think when you can get excited about all these aspects, that's also kind of the secret to the longevity within the sport, because you feel like there's always more to learn. So I think that's what I like about it, is I could never be bored doing this sport because there's always something to work on. There's always something to change or improve or test.
I love that about passions.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's the same with anything. Like, there's that saying that says, if you find something you love to do, you won't work a day in your life. Like, I have a buddy that builds and renovates things. And he said when he was younger, all he ever wanted to do was to build stuff. He had a pretty good job at one point, but he didn't love it. And when he and his wife were expecting their first kid, he quit his job and went back to school to be an engineer. And he said the flack he got from his parents and some of his friends, they're like, of all the times to quit when you're, you know, you've got all this responsibility coming. And he said, I wouldn't have changed it for anything in the world because I love everything about what I do now. Now I get to build things every day. And I think that's a key to anything that we do, that if you can take your job, if it's something that you're very passionate about, then it's very easy to be good at it.
I read that you sometimes quote the Shawshank Redemption's get busy living or get busy dying.
This one's been floating around for a while. It's kind of funny how it builds.
Oh, really? It like happened that one time and everybody keeps bringing it back to you?
Well, kind of. But I mean, it is a good quote. And I mean, it's a great movie. And I like it because it kind of gives a bit of a sense of urgency. I mean, we only have one life and you want to make the most of it and not regret things. And to me, that's important because I live paycheck to paycheck in this job. It doesn't pay much. And people are like, well, when's it time to retire and start, you know, having a real job? And while that starts to weigh heavily on me now as I get older, I also know that I wouldn't change anything at this point for what I've done and what I've been able to, what I've been allowed to achieve. My life's been very rich because of the experiences I've had, the places I've gone, the people that I've met. And to me, that's more important than any paycheck I could ever get.
Thanks to Brian McKeever for sharing his story with us. If you'd like to find out more about Brian McKeever, we'll have a link to his bio on our website, or you can follow him on Twitter at Brian McKeever.
As we mentioned, Brian will be joining us to speak at Edmonton Community Foundation's annual meeting. The meeting will be held over lunch on June 7th at the Wesson Hotel downtown. If you're interested in attending, you can RSVP by email at annualmeeting@ecfoundation.org or by calling 780-702-7628. We'd love for you to join us. So what's next, Janelle?
Jen Kish is a recently retired Canadian Olympic rugby player who has been part of the women's rugby sevens team since 2010. And captained the team to silver at the 2013 Women's Rugby World Cup. She won a gold medal at the 2015 Pan American Games, and in 2016, history was made as she led the Women's Rugby 7 team to a bronze medal at the Olympic Games in Rio. She is a global inspiration, and we are excited to speak with her today. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Yeah, you bet.
You will be speaking at the Edmonton Public Library Speaker Series on June the 14th. Is there anything in particular that you're going to be focusing on that day?
You know, I'm going to be telling my story. I'm going to be talking about a little bit about diversity and inclusion in sport. You know, trying to inspire people to join sport, especially kids. You know, giving people an inside look on what life is like for the past 13 years in my career, and talking a bit on grit as well.
We are really looking forward to hearing you speak. So we're just going to jump right in and get your perspective on some recent events. Stephanie LeBay, a highly regarded Canadian soccer player, she was in the news recently after being refused to play on the Calgary Foothills FC team because she's a woman. And this refusal even came after being told that she was good enough to play on the team.
Yes.
So it seems like there's been a lot of pushback for women in sports. So how do you feel about this? And should gender or sex be a deciding factor on who can play on what team?
Yeah, I know Steph LeBay and I know her well and we're good friends, and super unfortunate that, that's happening to her right now because, you know, there is no pro teams in Canada for her to play on. And, she wants to stay in Canada and she's good enough to be on a male's team, and yet her gender is stopping her. And I can relate to her because, you know, I played football and played with a bunch of guys and I wasn't welcomed there as well as I should have been because I earned the right to be there. So it's tough for women to find their place in sport. And I think, you know, people like Steph are making organizations think maybe you should rewrite the rules a bit, because I don't see a problem in a female or a male for that matter wanting to play with their counterpart. I guess fans do have an issue with it and society does have an issue with it. And I guess the controversy with staff is that, well, it's a men's league. And what are people saying? Like, well, if a guy wanted to play in the females league, would females like that? You know, if you're going to raise the level of the game, then sure, why not? By her being there, or by females playing male sports or males playing female sports, like if you're going to raise that level of the game, then why not? Like, I don't see the problem in that.
Yeah, those are some really good points. And that kind of leads right into my next question. How does the experience of being a pro athlete compare between men and women?
Men play on a bigger stage than women do. You know, they get paid more for what they do, and they're seen on television more than females are. And sometimes I have to blame the media for that because, you know, they cover the male sports a lot more than the female sports. You know, with Rio for rugby, you know, rugby has been Canada's biggest secret in sport, I think. When Canada and the media show rugby on the television, it just goes to show you put female sports on TV, people are going to find it exciting and they're going to want to watch it. And we gained a lot of fans from having our games on TV. It's hard enough trying to play a sport on top of trying to say that you deserve to be there. Like, you know, I want female athletes to just be able to focus on their sport and not being like, well, the funding's not there. And, you know, our games aren't being streamed and fighting a losing battle almost, it seems. But, you know, you have people like myself and Steph and, you know, Haley Wickenheiser and Cassie Campbell, you know, everyone's fighting for women in sport, and we're getting a little bit further and further each day, and we're never going to stop. But I just wish it was on equal playing field. But a little bit of everything that plays a factor in it, but I think it's a lot further now than it has been.
So on that note, what would be your advice then for women in sports, or women who are aspiring to be in sports?
I think if you know, women want to play sports, they just got to know that there's going to be a lot of obstacles males don't necessarily see or have to fight through, but like, don't let that stop them from doing what they love. I didn't join rugby to get paid millions. I joined rugby because I loved the sport and it made me a better person and it gave me lifelong friends. And you know, if you end up with an agent and some sponsors at the end of the day, then that's icing on the cake, right? You know, you got to keep your passion for what you do.
That's really great advice. So you have actually been in the news a lot recently with the announcement of your retirement.
Yeah.
How have you been since this announcement, and what kind of responses have you been receiving?
I've been great. You know, I think people are having, you know, a bigger reaction to it than I am. I just recently came from Canada Sevens in Victoria at our home tournament, and a lot of the things that people were saying is, oh, I can't believe you're done. Are you sure? Are you okay? Or, you know, congratulations on the retirement. Retirement is scary. You got to find something else to do. And it's, you know, I'm getting a lot of mixed responses. I know I made the right decision. I'm excited for the next chapter in my life, and I'm excited to let my body heal and contribute back to sport now as much as I can, now that I have all this kind of free time on my hands.
So what is next for you? What's the next step in your journey?
The next step in my journey, well, you know, I have some sponsorship commitments that I'll be doing. I'm going to be trying to get a lot of kids involved in sport. I'm going to be doing personal training. I'm going to be helping other people achieve their fitness goals. You know, there's nothing more rewarding than that. And then, you know, just kind of keeping my face in rugby, coaching my club. Recently, I was part of a cancer campaign for Color Your Hair to Conquer Cancer and raising funds for that. Just supporting people and giving back and help, yeah, just keeping busy, I guess.
It seems like your father has really been a huge support and inspiration to you throughout your career. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
So my dad was a single parent. He, you know, he's always had several jobs just to pay for my sports. He's been my biggest supporter. He knows the value of sports and what they can bring to someone's life. So he made sure whatever sport I wanted to go in, that he would put me in. He's the sole reason why I even made it to Rio, why I was able to complete a childhood dream of mine. I'm forever, forever grateful for that. And along the way, he's given me great advice when adversity is struck. He's really been my rock through this whole athletic journey of mine. And I hope to, like, kind of enlighten parents who want their kids in sports, but the kids aren't interested in sports. My brother wasn't necessarily interested in sports, but he still played it. My brother's a better person because he did play sports. So, yeah, my dad has just been like a great role model to me. I had so much respect for him because it's hard raising two kids when you have no money.
Wow, that is a really cool story. Before we part ways, I know I can't see you, but I know that you have a lot of really cool tattoos, and I know that you have a interesting tattoo on your calf. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that tattoo and what it means to you?
I actually have two tattoos on my calf, on each calf. The one tattoo I got after Rio, it's the Olympic torch. The flame is in Rio colors with the Olympic rings in it, and, you know, when I look at that, that is just reminding me of the achievement that I accomplished in 2016. But the most recent tattoo is actually on my right calf, and I have 12 leaves, and by the end of this season I was going to get number 13 to finish the season, because this is my 13th year playing for Canada. So each leaf represents the year I've actually represented Canada. I have where my dream started on one leg and kind of where my dream ended on the other.
Wow, that's amazing.
Tattoos are an expensive hobby, but, you know, I'm super grateful to have a great tattoo artist.
I love the tattoo ideas that you have. Is there anything that you wanted to add that maybe we didn't talk about that you wanted to mention before we leave?
I just hope that people come out on the 14th to hear my story, to hear my talk. I hope to, you know, meet a lot of people because that's what I love to do.
Well, we are really looking forward to hearing you speak on the 14th, Jen. Thank you so much again for taking time out to talk with us today.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much to Jen Kish for sharing your time with us. Jen is the next guest speaker for the Edmonton Public Library's Forward Thinking Speaker Series. She'll be speaking on Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the ATB Financial Arts Barn. Tickets are just $10 and you can get them through Eventbrite. We'll be sure to have the link up on our website.
Edmonton Community Foundation has the privilege of working with some very generous donors who create funds that help support a wide variety of charities throughout Edmonton. We'd like to introduce you to Evelyn Shaquan.
My name is Evelyn Shaquan. The name of the fund is the Owen Schlosser Fund.
We caught up with Evelyn at our donor appreciation event earlier in May. It was a warm, sunny day at the zoo, and Evelyn took a bit of time to tell us her donor story.
So we created the Owen Schlosser Fund in memory of my brother Owen, who died from cancer when he was 21 years old in 2009. He was diagnosed with skin cancer, and we lost him really quickly, which was a shock to, you know, our family and our friends and our community. And we created the fund in his memory to help children who can't access sports play sports. So that's sort of the spirit of the fund, and we do everything from provide, you know, registration fee coverage to equipment or help kids play the sports that Owen loved so much while he was alive. Everyone has busy lives and, you know, careers and jobs and all kinds of things going on, but one of the most powerful or impactful things that is going on in my life is actually working to raise funds and decide where the funds are going through the Edmonton Community Foundation and through the Owen Schlosser Fund specifically. And it's just so incredibly rewarding to see actual lives impacted by the dollars, young children who truly wouldn't maybe be able to play sport otherwise have that chance. And there's a lot of things that I do in my daily life, but this is probably the most rewarding thing that I do. Even though it's sort of in a sad way, it's brought a lot of joy to so many people, and it's really just been an incredible experience.
Thanks to Evelyn Shaquan. If you'd like to learn more about the Owen Schlosser Fund, we'll have the link on our site. And we'll also share some info about how you can create your own fund too.
Every episode, we like to give a shout out to one of the excellent podcasts from the Alberta Podcast Network. Lisa, why don't you scoot over to this mic and tell us what you've been listening to?
Thanks, Elizabeth. I've been keeping up with the youngins with That's a Thing. That's a Thing is a podcast by Karen Unland and her daughter, Elizabeth Spencer. Elizabeth guides her mom and the rest of us olds through some of the trends, slang, and everyday worlds of folks under 20 years old. It is a lot of fun to listen to, and there's always a lot to learn. For example, what you might think of when you hear the word Fortnite is not at all what the teens and tweens are thinking about. You'll have to tune in to episode 6 of That's a Thing to find out more. You can find That's a Thing at thatsathingatlisbon.com or on the CKUA radio app, where you can subscribe to all of the amazing shows on the Alberta Podcast Network. And as always, we'll have the link on our website.
Thanks, Lisa. We're nearing the end of our show, which means
news time.
Yep. We have two grant deadlines to remind you about. Take a listen to see if you or someone you know is eligible for some funding.
First up are the ECF awards and bursaries. These awards range from $1,000 to $4,000. They are for students from Edmonton and Northern Alberta who have a history of community involvement or leadership and with financial need. Deadline to apply is June 15th.
And the second is vital signs grants. These relate to the Vital Signs Report, a yearly checkup conducted by ECF that measures how our community is doing on specific topics compared to national averages. Vital Signs grants are ECF's way of going beyond simply identifying the needs in the community. Charitable organizations can apply for up to $10,000 this year to focus on projects and programs that seek to increase a sense of belonging in the community. Deadline to apply to this is also June 15th.
Be sure to visit our website for more details about each of these grants. We'll be sure to have all the links at thewellendowedpodcast.com.
And that brings us to the end of the June edition of the Well Endowed Podcast. Thanks to Brian McKeever and Jen Kish for sharing their stories with us.
And thank you for listening. We really appreciate it and hope you enjoyed the show.
If you did, please be sure to share this episode with your friends and subscribe to us on iTunes and Google Play. We've been your hosts, Elizabeth Bonkink,
Janelle Jensen,
and Andrew Paul. Until next time.
The Well Endowed Podcast is produced by Edmonton Community Foundation
and is an affiliate member of the Alberta Podcast Network.
The show is edited by Lisa Pruden.
You can visit our website at thewellendowedpodcast.com.
Subscribe to us on iTunes.
And follow us on Twitter at @TheECF.
Our theme music is by Octavo Productions.
And as always, don't forget to visit Edmonton Community Foundation at ecfoundation.org.
Well Endowed.